20. A Study of a Great Life. Two-thirds of a century. The beginnings lost in a blue haze. And who then could have imagined in his wildest dreams how it would end? Looking backward, it was difficult to resurrect and believe in the beginning. He had been born to a life without hope, an illegitimate son, registered in the name of a drunken, penniless cobbler, an illiterate mother, grubby little so-so forever splashing about in the puddles near Queen Tamara's Hill. How could such a child ever escape from the depths of degradation, let alone become ruler of the world? But the author of his existence had pulled strings, and although he did not belong to a priestly family, the boy had been admitted, contrary to the established practice of the church, first to a church school, then, still more remarkably, to a seminary. From the highest point of the blackened iconostasis, the god of Sabaoth sternly summoned the novice prostrate on the cold stone flags. Oh, how zealously the boy had entered into the service of his god! How unreservedly he surrendered himself! In his 6 years of schooling, he crammed into himself as best he could the Old and New Testaments, the lives of the saints, and church history, and he was a punctilious altar boy. Yet there it was in his biography, a snapshot of Djougashvili, wearing a grey cassock with a round buttoned collar before he was expelled. There was no colour in his boyishly oval face. He looked exhausted by prayer. His hair, grown long in readiness for his ordination, was carefully parted, humbly smeared with oil from the icon lamps, and combed down right over his ears. Only his eyes and his tense brows hinted that here was a novice who might some day be an archbishop. But God had disappointed him. Time had left behind the odious, sleepy little town where the Medjuda and the Lyakhva meander among rounded green hills. In noisy Tiflis, clever people had realized long ago that God was a joke, and the ladder up which Soso was so tenaciously climbing led, he saw now, not to heaven, but to a pauper's garret. He was at a boisterous and bellicose age. He longed for action. Time was passing, and nothing had been achieved. He had no money to go to university, obtain a government post, or set up in business. Instead, there was socialism, which turned no one away. Socialism, which was used to seminarians. He felt no inclination toward any art or science. He lacked the know-how to become an artisan or a thief. He was not successful enough with women to become the lover of a rich lady. But revolution summoned all men, received them with open arms, and promised them a place. At his own suggestion, his favourite photograph of himself had been inserted at this point in the book. There he was, almost in profile. He was wearing not exactly a beard or a moustache or sideburns. He simply hadn't shaved for quite a while, and beard, moustache, and sideburns had run together in a picturesque, manly growth. He was all eagerness, all aspiration, but he did not yet know to what. What a likeable young man! A frank, clever, energetic face, not a trace of the fanatical novice. Free now of the lamp oil, his hair had sprung up and flopped forward to conceal what was perhaps a rather unsatisfactory feature, his low, sloping forehead. He was poor. His jacket had been shabby when he bought it. A cheap, checkered scarf was draped around his neck with bohemian abandon, covering his unhealthily narrow chest in lieu of a shirt. One of many such young men in Tiflis, surely doomed to tuberculosis. Whenever Stalin looked at that photograph, his heart filled with pity, for no heart is altogether incapable of it. How difficult everything had been for him. The whole world was against that splendid young man, his only shelter a cold but rent-free closet at the observatory after his expulsion from the seminary. He had wanted for safety's sake to combine the two things, and for 4 years had attended social democratic study groups while continuing to say his prayers and recite his catechism, but they had expelled him just the same. 11 years of prayer and genuflection had gone for nothing. All the more resolutely did he transfer his youthful energies to the revolution. But revolution, too, had proved a disappointment. What sort of revolution was it anyway, in Tiflis? Big-headed braggarts playing games in a wine cellar. You could get lost in this anthill of non-entities, They had no concept of advancement by regular stages or of seniority. It was just a question of who could out-talk whom. The former seminarian came to hate those chatterers more than he hated provincial governors or policemen. Why be angry with them? They earned their salary honestly and naturally had to defend themselves, but there was no excuse for these upstarts. Revolution? Among Georgian shopkeepers? It would never happen. And now he had cut himself off from the seminary, lost what should have been his way in life. The hell with it anyway, this so-called revolution. All these paupers, workers who boozed their wages away, sick old women, people cheated of a few odd kopecks. Why was he supposed to love them and not his young, clever, handsome, unappreciated self? It was only in Batum, when he led a couple of hundred people, including the idly curious, along a street for the first time that Koba, his revolutionary nickname, felt the thrill of power. People were following him. After that first experience, he never forgot the taste of it. This was the life that he was made for, the only sort of life he could understand. You speak, and people have to do what you say. You show them where to go, and people have to go there. There is nothing better than this, nothing finer in the world. Riches are nothing in comparison. A month later, the police bestirred themselves and arrested him. Nobody feared arrest in those days. It meant very little. You were in custody for 2 months, and when you were let out, you were a martyr. Koba behaved admirably in the common cell and encouraged the others to treat their jailers with contempt. But they hung on to him. All his cellmates went and were replaced by others. He was still inside. What, after all, had he done? No one was punished so severely for an insignificant demonstration. A whole year went by, and he was transferred to a dark, damp, one-man cell in Kutaisi jail. Here he began to despair. Life was going by, and instead of rising in the world, he was sinking even lower. The damp gave him a painful cough. And all this gave him even more reason to hate those professional loudmouths, fortune's favourites, it seemed. Why did they get away with revolution so lightly? Why weren't they kept inside as long? Then one day a gendarme officer he knew from Batum arrived at Kutaisi jail. "Well, Djougashvili, have you had time to think? This is only the beginning, Djougashvili. We shall keep you here until you either rot with consumption or correct your line of conduct. We want to save you and your soul. You were 5 minutes away from becoming a priest, Father Iosif. Why did you join that gang? You don't belong with them. Tell me that you're sorry." He was indeed sorry, so very sorry. His second spring in jail was ending. His second dreary summer of jail lay ahead. Why, oh why, had he thrown away a modest position in the church? How rash he had been! The wildest imagination could not conceive of revolution in Russia in less than 50 years' time, when Iosif would be 73. What good would revolution be to him then? But it wasn't just that. By now Iosif had gotten to know himself, to realize that he was by nature deliberate and methodical, a lover of order and stability. But these were the very qualities, order, stability, solidity, consistency, that sustained the Russian Empire. What was the point of trying to destabilize it? The officer with his corn-colored moustache paid visit after visit. Iosif found his trim gendarme's uniform with its handsome shoulder boards, neat buttons, piping, and buckles most attractive. "What I am offering you is, after all, an opportunity to serve the state." Iosif was ready to transfer once and for all to the service of the state, but he had spoiled his chances at Tiflis and Batum. "You will receive an allowance from us. To begin with, you will help us by working among the revolutionaries. Choose the most extreme faction. Start playing a leading role in it. We will always handle you carefully. You will communicate with us in such a way that no shadow of suspicion will fall on you. But first, so as not to compromise you, we will transport you under guard to a distant place of exile, and you will leave it immediately. That's what everybody does." Djougashvili was not long in deciding. The third wager of his young life was laid on the secret police. He was exiled to Irkutsk province in November. Among other exiles there, he read a letter from a certain Lenin, well known for his newspaper Iskra. Lenin had isolated himself at the outermost limit of the movement, and was now writing around in quest of supporters. He was obviously the man to join. Iosif left the dreadful frosts of Irkutsk toward Christmas, and was in the sunny Caucasus before the war with Japan broke out. From then on, he enjoyed a long period of immunity. He met underground activists, composed leaflets, convened meetings. Others were arrested, especially those he didn't like. But he escaped notice and was not on the wanted list. Nor was he called up for military service. Then, suddenly, though nobody was expecting it so soon, no preparations had been made, nothing had been organized, it was upon them. Crowds marched through Petersburg bearing political petitions. Grand dukes and other bigwigs were assassinated. Ivanova Voznesensk was on strike. Luzh rebelled. The battleship Potemkin mutinied. A manifesto was squeezed out of the Tsar, in spite of which machine guns were soon chattering in the Presnya district of Moscow, and the railways were brought to a standstill. Kober was stunned, thunderstruck. Could he have made yet another mistake? Why was he so completely lacking in foresight? The Akhranka had misled him. He was a three-time loser. Give me back my uncompromised revolutionary soul! Trapped in a vicious circle. Tumble Russia into a revolution, and the day afterward your denunciations will come tumbling out of the Akhranka archives. But after all the shooting, the uproar, the hangings, they looked around and the revolution had vanished. This was when the Bolsheviks adopted the sound revolutionary practice of expropriation. Some Armenian moneybags would be sent a letter telling him where to bring along 10, 15, or 25,000 rubles. And the moneybags would bring the money to persuade them not to blow up his shop or kill his children. This was the real thing. This was what genuine revolutionaries should be doing. Not wasting time on scholastic arguments, leaflets, demonstrations. This was real revolutionary activity. The goody-goody Mensheviks grumbled that robbery and terrorism were incompatible with Marxism. Oh, how mercilessly Kober ridiculed them, hunting them down like cockroaches. It was for this that Lenin called him the marvellous Georgian. The X's were robbery, but what else was revolution? Wasn't that robbery? How ridiculous they were, those sanctimonious humbugs. Where else would you get money for the party? Where? From the revolutionaries themselves? A bird in hand is worth two in the bush. The X's were in fact the form of revolutionary activity that Kober liked most of all. And no one was as clever as Kober at recruiting uniquely reliable people like Kamo, who would unquestioningly obey his orders, brandish a revolver, snatch a sack of gold, and take it to Kober. When they snatched 340,000 rubles from the couriers of a Tiflis bank, that could be seen as a proletarian revolution in miniature, and only idiots lived in expectation of the big one. This was one of the things that the police did not know about Kober, and the dividing line between police and revolution remained as before. He was never short of money. The revolution now carried him around on continental trains and on ships, showed him islands, canals, and medieval castles, all rather different from a stinking Kutaisi cell. In Tammerfors, Stockholm, and London, Kober was able to take a close look at the Bolsheviks and the manic Lenin. They took good care of him. The more prominent, the better known he became in the party, the nearer to home his places of exile were. He would be banished now not to Baikal, but to Solvichegodsk, and for 2 years, not three. Between spells of banishment, he was allowed to play at revolution unhindered. Finally, after he had walked away three times from exile in Siberia and the Urals, the implacable and indefatigable rebel was shunted off to Vologda, of all places, where he lodged in the police chief's apartment and could reach Petersburg by train overnight. But one February evening in 1912, Orjonikidze, a junior colleague in the Baku days, arrived in Vologda from Prague, shook him by his shoulders and shouted, "So-so! So-so! You've been co-opted to the CC!" The moon shone on wreathing frozen mist as the 32-year-old Koba, wrapped up in his fur coat, paced the yard for hours. He was vacillating yet again. Member of the Central Committee? Ah, but Malinowski was both a member of the Bolshevik Central Committee and a deputy in the State Duma. Lenin was particularly fond of Malinowski. So what? That was under the Tsar. After the revolution, anyone in the CC today was sure to be a minister. No revolution could be expected, of course, in his lifetime. But even without revolution, a Central Committee member had some sort of power. Whereas his prospects in the employment of the secret police were... what? He would always be an insignificant snooper, instead of a member of the Central Committee. No, he must part company with the security police. Arzyev's hideous fate haunted him day and night. The following morning they took the train to Petersburg, where they were promptly arrested. The young and inexperienced Odzhonikidze was given 3 years in the Schlüsselburg fortress, with banishment to follow. Stalin, true to form, was merely banished for 3 years. True, it was to a rather distant place, the Narim region. This was meant as a warning. But communications in the Russian Empire were not too bad, and in late summer Stalin made his way safely back to Petersburg. He now switched his efforts mainly to party work. He visited Lenin in Krakow, no difficult matter even for an exile. He organized a printing press here, a May Day demonstration there, a leaflet campaign somewhere else, and suddenly, at an evening meeting in the Kalashnikov Labor Exchange, he was nabbed. The Okhranka had lost its temper, and this time he was sent packing to a real place of exile, Kurieka, beyond the Arctic Circle. The Tsar's government could dish out ruthless sentences when it wanted to, and he got, horror of horrors, 4 years, 4 whole years. Stalin faltered yet again. For what and for whom had he renounced his comfortable, uneventful life under state patronage and gotten himself banished to this godforsaken hole? Member of the CC might tickle the ear of an idiot, but... Several hundred members of assorted parties shared Stalin's exile, and when he looked at them, he was horrified. What a loathsome breed these professional revolutionaries were! Empty show-offs, loudmouths, incapable of independent action, mentally bankrupt. Stalin, the Caucasian, dreaded the Arctic Circle less than the company of these flimsy, unstable, irresponsible, unserious people. To cut himself off from them once and for all, he would sooner have lived with the bears. He married a Cheldonian, a mammoth of a woman with a squeaky voice. Better her tittering and the evil-smelling fat she cooked in than all those assemblies, debates, altercations, comrades' courts. Stalin let it be known that he wanted nothing to do with these people, broke off relations with them, and with the revolution too. Enough was enough. At 35 he was not too old to start living honestly. There comes a time when you must stop drifting before the wind, with your empty pockets like billowing sails. He despised himself for wasting so many years with those pathetic hacks. From then on, he was a man apart, steering clear of Bolsheviks and anarchists alike. He had no thought now of escaping. His intention was to serve out his sentence like an honest exile. Besides, war had broken out, and only there in exile could he be sure of surviving. He stayed put with his Cheldonian woman, keeping his head down. A son was born to them. The war seemed never-ending. He would have fought tooth and nail for an extra year of exile. Russia had a Tsar too feeble even to hand down a decent sentence. The war went on, and the police department, with which he had once been on such good terms, handed his file card and his soul with it to a recruiting officer who didn't know the first thing about social democrats and their central committees, and who called up Iosif Djugashvili, born 1879, no previous military service, to serve as a private in the Imperial Russian Army. That was the beginning of the future Great Marshal's military career. He had tried three different careers, one after another, and now he would be embarking on a fourth. A sleepily gliding sled carried him along the Yenisei to Krasnoyarsk, and on to the barracks at Achinsk. He was in his 38th year, and he was a nothing, a Georgian soldier, shivering in a skimpy greatcoat, cannon fodder for the front in transit across frozen Siberia. A great life was about to be cut short around some Belarusian farmstead or some Jewish shtetl. But before he had learned to roll up a greatcoat or load a rifle, in later years, as a commissar and then a marshal, he still didn't know how and would have been embarrassed to ask. Ticker-tape messages from Petrograd caused people to hug one another in the streets and shout steamily into the frosty air, "Christ is risen!" The Tsar had abdicated. The Empire was no more. How had it happened? Who had brought it about? They had given up hope, stopped counting on it. "Unknowable, O Lord, are thy ways?" How true were those words Iosif remembered from his childhood. No one could remember when the Russian public had last rejoiced so unanimously. But until another telegram arrived, Stalin could not join in the general jubilation. Till then, the spectre of Azif, hanged by the neck, dangled importunately over his head. The news he needed came one day later. The Okhranka's headquarters had been sacked and burned. All its documents had been destroyed. They knew, those revolutionaries, what to burn first. Stalin felt sure that there were others like himself in the files, quite a few of them. The Okhranka had gone up in flames, but for the rest of his life, Stalin was watchful and suspicious. With his own hands, he paged through tens of thousands of archival pages and pitched whole files into the flames without examining them. Still, he missed something, and in 1937 it very nearly saw the light of day. Whenever a member of his own party was put on trial, Stalin invariably accused him of having been a police informer. He had learned how easy it is to fall, and found it hard to imagine that others had failed to ensure themselves as he had. Stalin later refused to speak of the great February Revolution. But he had forgotten how he himself had rejoiced and sung and winged his way from Achinsk. There was nothing now to stop him from deserting, and done foolish things, and handed in at a post office in the backwoods a telegram to Lenin in Switzerland. Once in Petrograd, he had immediately agreed with Kamenev that this was it, all that they had dreamed of in their underground days. The revolution was complete, and all they had to do was consolidate its achievement. This was a time for practical people, especially those who were already members of the CC. They must do all in their power to support the provisional government. It was all so clear to them until that adventurer, who knew nothing about Russia, who lacked all-around practical experience, arrived and, spluttering, slurring, twitching, came out with his April theses and created total confusion. Yet somehow he cast a spell over the party and dragged it into the July uprising. This desperate adventure failed, as Stalin had foretold, and the whole party almost went under with it. And where did the strutting gamecock turn up next? He had saved his skin by fleeing to the Gulf of Finland, while the foulest abuse was heaped upon Bolsheviks back home. Was his liberty more valuable than the prestige of the party? Stalin had posed the question candidly at the Sixth Congress, but had not obtained a majority. Altogether, 1917 had been an unpleasant year. Too many meetings, eloquent ranters were carried on the crowd's shoulders. Trotsky was never off the stage in the circus building. Where had they all come from, these nimble-tongued ninnies, swarming like flies onto honey? He had never seen them in exile, never seen them when he was carrying out X's. They had been idling abroad, and now they had come back to yap their heads off and sneak into the front row. Whatever the subject under discussion, they hopped onto it as quick as fleas. They always knew the answer before the question was asked, before the problem arose. They laughed at Stalin openly, insultingly. True, he steered clear of their debates, never sat on platforms. For the time being, he was keeping his own counsel. He did not like bandying words, trying to shout an opponent down, and he was no good at it. This was not how he had imagined the revolution. Occupying important posts, doing a serious job, that was what he had looked forward to. They laughed at him, all those pointy beards. But why was it on Stalin that they loaded all the heaviest and most thankless tasks? They laughed at him, but why did all the others in Kseshinskaya's former palace suddenly develop stomach aches and send Stalin to Petropavlovka when the sailors had to be persuaded to surrender the fortress to Kerensky without a fight and themselves withdraw to Kronstadt? Why? Because the sailors would have stoned, say, Grishka Zinoviev. Because you had to know how to talk to the Russian people. The October Revolution had been another reckless venture, but it had come off. Good. Full marks to Lenin there. Nobody knew what would follow, but for the time being, good. Commissariat of Nationalities? Very well, then. I don't mind. Draw up a constitution. Why not? Stalin was sizing up the situation. Surprisingly, for a year, the revolution looked like a complete success. Nobody would ever have expected it, but there it was. That clown Trotsky even believed in world revolution and opposed the Brest-Litovsk peace treaty. In fact, Lenin, too, believed in it. Pedants. Fantasists. Only an ass would believe in a European revolution. They had lived there for years and learned nothing. Whereas Stalin had travelled across Europe once and understood it completely. They should thank heaven that their own revolution had been a success and sit quietly. Pause for thought. Stalin looked around with a sober and unprejudiced eye, thought things over, and saw clearly that these phrase-mongers would ruin this great revolution. Only he, Stalin, could steer it in the right direction. In all honesty, in all conscience, he was the only real leader among them. He compared himself dispassionately with those poseurs, those mountebanks, and he saw clearly his own essential superiority, their instability, his own staying power. What set him apart from all the others was his understanding of people. He understood them at the point where they touched ground, at the base. Understood that part of them without which they would not stand on their feet and remain standing. Everything higher than that, all the pretenses, all the boasts, was superstructure and of no importance. Lenin, of course, could soar like an eagle. He could amaze you. Turn right around overnight and say, "Let the peasants have the land. We can always change our minds later." Think up the Brest-Litovsk Treaty in a single day. Even a Georgian, let alone a Russian, suffered when he saw half of Russia handed over to the Germans, but Lenin felt nothing. As for the new economic policy, it went without saying, that was the neatest trick of the lot. Nobody need be ashamed to learn from such manoeuvres. Lenin's greatest gift, the most remarkable thing about him, was his ability to hold the real power very tightly in his own two hands. Slogans changed, the subjects of debate changed, allies and opponents changed, but all power remained in his hands and his hands alone. But the man could not really be relied on. He was storing up a lot of grief for himself with his economic policy. He was bound to trip himself up with it. Stalin accurately sensed Lenin's volatility, his reckless impatience, and, worst of all, his poor understanding, or rather, total lack of understanding, of people. He had tested it on himself. Whichever side of himself he chose to show was the only one that Lenin saw. The man was no good at infighting in the dark, in other words, real politics. Trukhan, 66 degrees latitude, was a tougher place than Shushenskaya, 54 degrees, and Stalin felt himself that much tougher than Lenin. Anyway, what experience of life had this bookworm theoretician ever acquired? Lowly birth, humiliations, poverty, actual hunger had not been his lot. He had been a landowner, though a pretty small one. He had been a model exile and never once run away. He had never seen the inside of a real prison. Indeed, he had seen nothing of the real Russia. He had idled away 14 years in emigration. Stalin had read less than half of his writings, not expecting to learn a great deal from him. He did, of course, sometimes produce remarkably apt definitions. What is dictatorship? Unlimited government, unrestrained by laws. Stalin had written "good" in the margin. If Lenin had had a sound, sober understanding, he would have made Stalin his closest associate from the start. He would have said, "Help me! I understand politics, I know about social classes, but real live people I don't understand." But the best thing he could think of was to pack Stalin off to some far corner of Russia, where he was put in charge of grain requisitioning. Stalin was the man he needed most in Moscow, so he sent him to Tsaritsyn. Lenin arranged things so that he sat in the Kremlin throughout the Civil War, while Stalin's lot for 3 whole years was that of a nomad, scouring the whole country, shaken to bits on horseback or in an unsprung cart, frozen half the time, trying to thaw out by a campfire. Stalin, of course, admired himself in those years. He was a sort of young general without formal rank, elegant and smart, wearing a leather cap with a star, a cavalry officer's double-breasted coat of fine cloth, unbuttoned, and soft leather riding boots, made to order. The clever young face was clean-shaven, except for the flowing moustache. No woman could resist him, and his third wife was a beauty. Of course, he never held a sabre, never got in the way of bullets. He was too valuable to the revolution. He was not like that mujik Budeni. Whenever you arrived somewhere new, Tsaritsyn, Perm, or Petrograd, you would keep quiet for a while, then ask a few questions, stroke your moustache, write "to be shot" on a list or two, and people would soon begin to show you great respect. Besides, if the truth be told, he had shown himself to be a great soldier and the architect of victories. The whole gang who had scrambled to the top and crowded around Lenin, struggling for power, all thought themselves very clever, very subtle, very complex. Their complexity, in fact, was what they particularly boasted about. Where 2 clearly made 4, they would shriek in a chorus that you were 0.12 short. The worst of the lot, the foulest of them all, was Trotsky. Stalin had simply never met such a loathsome person in all his life, with his insane conceit, his oratorical pretensions. And he would never argue honestly. There was never a straight yes or no. It always had to be both yes and no, or neither yes nor no. Neither peace nor war. What rational human being could make sense of that? And his arrogance? Rolling around like the Tsar himself in a sitting room on wheels. What sort of supreme commander could he make, with no strategic flair at all? This Trotsky's behavior so galled and annoyed him that Stalin at first lost control and broke rule number 1 for all politicians. Never let a man see that you are his enemy. Never let your irritation show. Stalin, instead, was openly insubordinate, abused Trotsky in letters and in conversation, and missed no opportunity to complain about him to Lenin. As soon as he heard about Trotsky's opinion or decision on any matter whatsoever, he would immediately put forward reasons for doing just the opposite. But that was no way to win. Trotsky bowled him over like a ninepin. Trotsky chased him out of Tsaritsyn and out of the Ukraine. And on one occasion, Stalin was taught the harsh lesson that not all means of struggle are good, that some holds are barred. At a Politburo meeting, he and Zinoviev joined in complaining about Trotsky's unauthorized executions, whereupon Lenin took several blank sheets of paper, signed at the bottom of each page with the words "approved in advance," and in their presence handed these to Trotsky to fill in when he pleased. He learned his lesson. He was ashamed. What had he been complaining about? Lenin was right, and so, just for once, was Trotsky. If you couldn't shoot people without trial, you would never be able to make history at all. We are all human, and our senses are quicker to prompt us than our reason. Every man gives off a scent, and that scent tells you how to act before your head does. Stalin, of course, had made a mistake in openly opposing Trotsky too soon. It was a mistake he never made again. But he sensed correctly that he should stand up to Lenin. His reason would have told him to truckle to Lenin, always to say, "Oh, how right you are! I'm with you there." But Stalin's unerring instinct found a very different way. To speak to Lenin as roughly as he could, to resist as stubbornly as a Georgian donkey. "I'm an uneducated man, a rough diamond, a bit of a savage. You'll have to take me as I am, or not at all." He wasn't just rough, but boorishly insolent. "I can only stay another 2 weeks at the front, and then you'd better give me some leave." Would Lenin have forgiven anyone else for such a thing? This inflexible, intransigent Stalin it was who won Lenin's respect. Lenin realized that this marvelous Georgian was a strong personality, that such people were much needed, and that as time went by, they would be needed more and more. Lenin listened readily to Trotsky, but he also gave Stalin a hearing. If he curbed Stalin, he reined in Trotsky too. The first was to blame for Tsaritsyn, the second for Astrakhan. "You must learn to cooperate," he would urge, but he had to accept their inability to get along. Trotsky came running to complain that although prohibition was enforced throughout the Republic, Stalin was drinking his way through the Tsar's cellar in the Kremlin. What if the soldiers at the front came to know of it? Stalin turned it into a joke. Lenin laughed. Trotsky stopped pointing his beard at them and went away empty-handed. When Stalin was removed from the Ukraine, he was given a second commissariat, Workers' and Peasants' Inspectorate, to make up for it. That was in March 1919. Stalin was into his 40th year. For anybody else, the WPI would have been a shabby little snooping operation, but under Stalin it rose to become the most important People's Commissariat. That was just what Lenin wanted. He knew Stalin's firmness, his unswerving sense of purpose, his incorruptibility. It was to Stalin that he entrusted the tasks of seeing justice done in the Republic, of keeping an eye on the morality of party officials, even the most important of them. If Stalin understood the nature of his work correctly and was prepared to devote himself to it, body and soul, with no thought for his health, he could now surreptitiously, but quite legally, gather incriminating evidence against all responsible officials, dispatch investigators, collect denunciations, and take charge of the ensuing purges. To do all this, he must create an apparatus, selecting from all over the country people as selfless, as unyielding as himself, and who, like him, were prepared to toil in obscurity for no visible reward. It was slow, demanding, painstaking work, but Stalin welcomed it. It is rightly said that we reach maturity at 40. Only then do we finally understand how to live and how to behave. Only then did Stalin become aware of his greatest strength, the power of the unspoken verdict. Your mind is made up, but the person whose head depends on your decision must not learn it too soon. Time enough for that when his head rolls. Another strength was his habit of disbelieving what others said and attaching no importance to his own words. Say not what you mean to do. You may not know it until the moment comes, but what puts the other person at ease? A third rule for the strong man is never to forgive anyone who betrays you, and if your teeth are in someone's throat, never to let go, though the sun rises in the west and portents appear in the heavens. A fourth rule for the strong man is not to rely on theory. Theory never helped anyone. You can always produce some sort of theoretical justification after the event. What you must always keep in mind is what fellow traveller you need for the present, and at which milestone you must part company. These rules helped him in due course to regularize the Trotsky situation, with the help of Zinoviev to begin with, and later that of Kamenev too. Cordial relations were established with both of them. It became obvious to Stalin that he need not have worried so much about Trotsky. No need to shove him into the ditch. He would jump and land in it unassisted. Stalin knew his business and worked away quietly, unhurriedly selecting cadres, trying people out, committing every one of them to memory so that he would know who could be relied on, looking for opportunities to promote and place them. The time came when, just as he had expected, Trotsky took a tumble unaided in the trade union controversy. His exhibitionist ravings infuriated Lenin. He shows no respect for the party. And Stalin was, conveniently, in a position to replace Trotsky's people, Krestinsky with Zinoviev, Preobrazhensky with Molotov, Serebryakov with Yaroslavsky. Voroshilov and Arjonidkidze, Stalin's own men, were hoisted into the Central Committee. The illustrious commander-in-chief was now unsteady on his heron's legs. And Lenin realized that Stalin was the unshakable defender of party unity, and that he asked for nothing, wanted nothing for himself. What won over all the leading comrades was the nice, guileless Georgian's refusal to join in the scramble for the platform, to court popularity, as all the others did. He never flaunted his knowledge of Marx. He worked away modestly, hand-picking party apparatchiks, a solitary comrade, true as steel, honest as the day was long, self-denying, diligent, a little undereducated, perhaps, a bit crude, rather limited. So when Lenin became ill, they elected Stalin secretary-general, rather as Mikhail Romanov was elected Tsar. So that was in May 1922. Anybody else would have been satisfied with that much and sat silently rejoicing. Not Stalin, though. Anybody else might have set about reading Das Kapital and making excerpts. Stalin, though, sniffed the air and knew that it was now or never. The conquests of the revolution were in danger. There was not a minute to lose. Lenin could not hang on to power and, left to himself, would not transfer it to safe hands. Lenin's health was precarious, and maybe that was for the best. If he survived as leader, there was no knowing what might happen. Nothing was certain. Erratic, bad-tempered, and now sick into the bargain, he was more irritating every day. He was simply a hindrance, in everybody's way. He could abuse a man, make him feel small, dismiss him from an elected post for no reason at all. Stalin's first idea was to dispatch Lenin to, say, the Caucasus for a rest cure. The air was good. There were out-of-the-way places which were without phone connections to Moscow and to which telegrams travelled slowly. A place like that, with no official business to be done, would steady his nerves. A tried and trusted comrade, the former expropriator, bank raider Carmo, could be on hand to keep an eye on his health. Lenin was willing, and arrangements were discussed with Tiflis, but there were inexplicable delays. In the meantime, Carmo was run over and killed. He had been talking too much about the X's. Whereupon Stalin, concerned for his leader's life, raised the question with the Commissariat of Health and the Professor of Surgery. The bullet fired by Fanny Kaplan had never been extracted. It was poisoning Lenin's organism. Should he not have another operation for its removal? The doctors were persuaded. They said as one man that it was necessary, and Lenin consented. But once again there were delays, and all that happened was that Lenin went off to Gorky. "We must be firm with Lenin," Stalin wrote to Kamenev. Kamenev and Zinoviev, his best friends at the time, agreed completely. Firm about his treatment, firm about his routine, firm about excluding him from official business for the sake of his precious life. And, of course, firm about keeping him away from Trotsky. Krupskaya, too, must be curbed. She was only an ordinary party member. Stalin was made officially responsible for the health of Comrade Lenin, and he did not consider it beneath him to deal directly with the doctors in charge, and even with nurses, to give them instructions on the most beneficial regimen for Lenin, which was to say no to him and keep saying no even if he got upset. In political matters, the prescription was the same. Lenin doesn't like the draft law on the Red Army. Right, push it through. Lenin doesn't like what we're doing about the Central Executive Committee. Right, push it through. Don't give way at any price. Remember, he's a sick man. He can't possibly know best. If he insists on something being done urgently, take your time over it. Postpone it. The Secretary General can even answer back, very rudely. It just means he's a straight shooter. He can't force himself to behave unnaturally, to do violence to his own character. Still, for all Stalin's exertions, Lenin made a slow recovery. His illness dragged on till autumn, when the argument about the Central Executive Committee grew heated and dear Ilyich was up and about only briefly. He left his bed only to resurrect in December 1922 his entente cordiale with Trotsky and against Stalin, of course. If that was all he had gotten up for, he had better go back to bed. Medical surveillance now became stricter. He was forbidden to read or write or be told anything about official business. He must just eat his gruel. But dear Ilyich took it into his head to write his political testament behind the Secretary-General's back, another move against Stalin. He dictated for 5 minutes a day, which was all he was allowed, all Stalin allowed him. But Stalin grinned into his moustache as the stenographer came clippity-clop along the corridor in her high heels, bringing him the obligatory copy. Next, Krupskaya had to be pulled up sharply, as she deserved, whereupon dear Ilyich got overheated and suffered his third stroke. All Stalin's efforts had failed to save his life. He had chosen a good time to die. Trotsky, as luck would have it, was in the Caucasus, and Stalin gave him the wrong date for the funeral, because there was no need for him to attend. It was much more fitting for the Secretary-General to pronounce the oath of loyalty, and very important that he should. But Lenin had left that will. It could set comrade against comrade. It might be misunderstood. Some people even wanted to replace the Secretary-General. So Stalin drew even closer to Zinoviev, assuring him that he was now the obvious leader of the party, and urging him as future leader to present the Central Committee's report to the 13th Congress, while Stalin retained his humble post of Secretary-General, which was all he wanted. So Zinoviev lauded it on the Congress platform, delivered his report, and that was all. He could hardly be elected to the non-existent post of leader of the party. But in return for this privilege, he persuaded the Central Committee that Lenin's testament would not even be read out at the Congress, and that Stalin would not be dismissed, since he had now mended his ways. The members of the Politburo were all of one mind at the time, all against Trotsky. They made a good job of rejecting his proposals and removing his supporters from their posts. And any other Secretary-General might have been satisfied. But Stalin, the indefatigable, the unblinking, knew that it was far too soon to relax. Would it be a good thing if Kamenev took Lenin's place as chairman of the Council of People's Commissars? When Stalin and Kamenev had visited the sick man together, reports in Pravda had made it appear that Stalin had gone alone, just in case. He foresaw that Kamenev, too, was not eternal. Maybe Rykov would be better. Well, Kamenev himself agreed, and so did Zinoviev. Such was the harmony among them all. But before long a great blow was struck at this friendship. It transpired that Zinoviev and Kamenev were humbugs and double-dealers. They were intent only on power. They did not cherish Lenin's ideas. They had to be cut down to size. They became the new opposition, and the garrulous Krupskaya found herself in their company, while Trotsky, after all the punishment he had taken, held his peace for the time being. The situation thus created was a very favourable one. The dawn of Stalin's friendship with the amiable Bukharin, the party's leading theorist, conveniently supervened at this point. Dear little Bukharin did the speech-making. Dear little Bukharin provided the theoretical foundations and justifications. The other lot called for an offensive against the kulak. So our slogan was, alliance between town and country. Stalin himself was not the least bit ambitious for fame, for authority. He just looked after the voting and made sure that the right man was in the right place. A lot of the right comrades were already in the posts where they were needed, and voting correctly. Zinoviev was dismissed from the Communist International. Leningrad was taken away from the opposition. You would have thought that they would have resigned themselves to the situation, but no. They now joined forces with Trotsky, and that poseur had one last inspiration, the slogan, industrialization. So Stalin and dear little Bukharin came out with party unity. For unity's sake, all must knuckle under. Trotsky was banished. Zinoviev and Kamenev were gagged. Another great help was the Lenin draft. After that, the majority of the party consisted of people untainted with the vices of the intelligentsia, uncontaminated by the squabbles which went on in the underground and in emigration, people to whom the former importance of party leaders meant nothing and their current image everything. Sound people, dedicated people, were rising from the depths of the party to occupy important posts. Stalin had never doubted that he would find such people, and that it was they who would save the conquest of the revolution. But fate had another surprise in store. Bukharin, Tomsky, and Rykov also proved to be two-faced. They did not stand up for the unity of the party. And Bukharin proved to be not the number one theorist, but the number one muddlehead. His crafty slogan, alliance between town and country, had a hidden significance. It hinted at the restoration of the old order, capitulation to the kulak, the abandonment of industrialization. Valid slogans were finally discovered. Only Stalin had been capable of formulating them. attack the Kulak, and force the pace of industrialization. And, of course, for party unity. It was the turn of this vile rightist gang to be swept out of the leadership. Bukharin, flattering himself, had once quoted some sage's dictum that inferior minds make better administrators. Wide of the mark, Nikolai Ivanovich, you and your sage. Sound minds it should be, not inferior minds. Your own mental capacity you demonstrated at your trials. Stalin had sat in a closed-off section of the gallery, watching them through a wire screen and smiling to himself. What orators they once were! How forceful they had once seemed! That they should come to this! Pathetic washouts! His understanding of human nature and his sober good sense had always been Stalin's strengths. He understood those he saw with his own eyes, but he also understood people whom he had not seen for himself. When things were difficult in 1931-32, and the country was without food and clothing, one good push from outside might have toppled us, or so it seemed. The party gave the command, "Sound the alarm! There is a danger of intervention!" But Stalin himself had never believed a word of it, because he had just as clear a picture of those other Western windbags. There was no way of measuring what it had cost in health and strength and stamina to cleanse the party and the country of their enemies, to cleanse Leninism, that infallible doctrine to which Stalin had never been false. He was doing precisely what Lenin had envisaged, only somewhat less drastically and without unnecessary fuss. So much effort. And yet things were never quiet. There was never a time when no one stood in the way. One minute it would be Tukhachevsky popping up to say that but for Stalin he would have taken Warsaw. Then Frunze stepped out of line, and the censor nodded. Or some trashy yarn pictured Stalin as a dead man upright on a mountain, and once again those idiots failed to spot it. Then the Ukraine left the crop rot in the fields. The Kuban opened fire from sawn-off shotguns. Ivanova, yes, Ivanova, went on strike. Never once did Stalin lose his self-control. Not after the mistake he had made with Trotsky. He knew that the mills of history grind slow, but they never stop turning. No need for a noisy show of indignation. All those who were jealous of him would go away, die, be trodden into the dung heap. Sorely wounded as Stalin was by those writers, he did not seek revenge, not for that. To do so would not have taught a lesson. He waited for another opportunity. There would always be an opportunity. And sure enough, everyone who in the Civil War had commanded so much as a battalion, so much as a company in units that were not loyal to Stalin, every last man of them went, disappeared. Delegates to the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, and 17th Congresses, as though answering a roll call, departed to a place from which no votes are cast, no speeches made. Mutinous Leningrad, that dangerous place, was twice purged. Even friends like Sergo had to be sacrificed. Even such diligent helpers as Yagoda and Yezhov had to be taken out afterward. And in time the long arm reached Trotsky and split his skull open. With no major enemy above ground, he had surely earned a breathing space. Finland poisoned it. Marking time on the Karelian isthmus, he had felt disgraced in the eyes of Hitler, who was strolling through France with his walking stick. An indelible blot on the military genius's reputation. Those Finns, that hostile nation of double-dyed bourgeois, ought to be deported down to the smallest child to the sands of the Karakum, and he himself would sit at the phone and keep the tally. So many shot and buried, so many still to go. Disasters rained on him thick and fast. Hitler tricked him and invaded, a lovely alliance wrecked out of sheer stupidity. His lips had trembled at the microphone as he blurted out the words involuntarily, "Brothers and sisters." There was no wiping them from the record now. But those brothers and sisters had fled like sheep. No one had been ready to fight to the death, although they had been given clear orders to do just that. Why didn't they stand and fight? Why had they not immediately stood and fought? It was hurtful. Then there was the evacuation to Kuibyshev, to the empty air raid shelters. He had always been master of the situation. He had never once weakened, except that one time, when he had succumbed to panic quite needlessly. He had paced his rooms for a week, had telephoned again and again. Has Moscow surrendered yet? No, it hasn't surrendered. It seemed incredible that the Germans would be halted. But our boys stopped them. Heroes, of course. Heroes. But many had to be taken out. It would be no victory if the rumour got around that the commander-in-chief had temporarily left the city. This explained the photographs taken of a small parade on November the 7th. Meanwhile, Berlin radio was washing all that dirty linen. The murders of Lenin, Frunze, Dzerzhinsky, Kuibyshev, Gorky. Why stop there? The old enemy, Churchill, who looked fat enough for a Georgian pork pot roast, flew in to smoke a couple of cigars in the Kremlin and gloat. The Ukrainians proved treacherous. In 1944, he had dreamed of resettling the whole Ukrainian population in Siberia, but there were too many of them to replace. There were other traitors, the Lithuanians, the Estonians, the Tatars, the Cossacks, the Kalmyks, the Chechens, the Ingush, the Latvians, yes, even the revolution's sturdiest prop, the Latvians. Even his own kin, the Georgians, who were safe from mobilization, he couldn't help suspecting that even they would welcome Hitler. The only ones who remained loyal to their father were the Russians and the Jews. So even the national question became a joke at his expense in those trying years. But those misfortunes, too, were in the past, thank God. Stalin had recovered a lot of ground by outwitting Churchill and the holier-than-thou Roosevelt. Since the 20s, he had scored no success to compare with his triumph over that pair of fools. Answering their letters or returning to his quarters after a meeting at Yalta, he couldn't help laughing at them. These statesmen, who thought themselves so clever, were more stupid than babes in arms. They would keep asking what things would be like after the war. Well, just send us your planes, send us your canned food, and when the time comes, we'll see. Toss them a word, the idlest passing thought, and they would jump for joy and rush to get it down on paper. Feign an excess of loving kindness, and they would be twice as soft. He had got from them, free, gratis, for nothing, Poland, Saxony, Thuringia, the Vlasovites, the Krasnovites, the Kuril Islands, Sakhalin, Port Arthur, half of Korea. He had run rings around them on the Danube and in the Balkans. The smallholders' leaders triumphed in the elections and went straight to jail. Mikolajczyk was quickly toppled. Benesch's heart gave out, as did Jan Masaryk's. Cardinal Mincenti confessed to his misdeeds. Dimitrov was admitted to the Kremlin Heart Clinic and there renounced his nonsensical plan for a Balkan federation. All Soviet citizens returning home after living in Europe were sent to the camps. All prisoners who had served only 1 10-year sentence were sent back to serve another. In a word, things seemed to be coming right at last. But when even the Siberian tiger no longer rustled with hints of an alternative socialism, the black dragon Tito crept into the open and blocked all roads ahead. Stalin, like some legendary hero, was exhausting his strength, hacking away at the endlessly proliferating heads of the Hydra. How could he have let himself be misled? Failed to discern the scorpion soul of the man. He, the great expert on human psychology. In 1936 they had Tito by the throat, and they had let him get away. Ay, 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 ay. Stalin groaned, swung his legs off the couch, and clutched his balding head. Vain regrets rankled in his bosom. He had toppled mountains, and he had tripped over a dunghill. Iosif had tripped over Iosif. That Kerensky was still living out his days somewhere or other did not trouble Stalin at all. Nicholas II or Kolchak could return from the grave. Stalin had no personal animosity toward any of these. They were honest enemies who did not turn themselves inside out to offer some new, improved socialism of their own. A better socialism. Different from Stalin's. The pipsqueak. Socialism without Stalin was no different from fascism. Not that Tito would get anywhere. Nothing could come of his efforts. As an old horse doctor who has slit open any number of bellies, chopped off innumerable extremities in smoky peasant huts, looks at a lady medic in the making, come to do her practical work in spotless white, that was how Stalin looked at Tito. But Tito made play with long-forgotten slogans from the early days of the revolution. Workers' control, land for the peasants, soap bubbles to fascinate idiots. Lenin's collected works had gone through 3 revised editions, the works of the Founding Fathers through 2. All those who had raised awkward questions, all who had been mentioned in obsolete footnotes, all who had thought of building socialism differently, had long ago fallen asleep. And now, when it was clear that there was no other way, and that not only socialism but communism would long ago have been constructed, if it were not for grandees who got too big for their boots, lying reports, soulless bureaucrats, indifference to the public good, slackness in organizational and explanatory work among the masses, lack of direction in the indoctrination of party members, deliberate delays in construction. If it were not for stoppages and absenteeism in industry, the production of substandard goods, poor planning, reluctance to adopt new technology, the non-performance of scientific research institutes, the inadequate training of young specialists, the reluctance of young people to take jobs out in the wilds, sabotage by prisoners, loss of grain in the fields, the embezzlements by bookkeepers, pilfering at depots, thieving stockroom and shop managers, predatory truckers. If it were not for complacent local authorities, excessively tolerant and venal militiamen, criminal misuse of the housing stock, brazen black marketing, greedy housewives, spoiled children, trolley car gossips, nitpicking writers, cockeyed filmmakers. When everyone could see that communism was on the right road and not far from completion, that cretin Tito and his Talmudist Cardiel reared their ugly heads and declared that this was not the way to build communism. At this point, Stalin realized that he was talking aloud, chopping the air, that his heart was beating furiously, his eyes were clouding, and an unpleasant urge to twitch had crept into his limbs. He took a deep breath, stroked his face and his moustache, took another deep breath. He must not let it all get him down. Ah, yes, he had to see Abakumov. He was about to rise, but his eyes had cleared, and he spotted a little black and red booklet, published in a cheap mass edition, on his telephone table. He reached for it in pleasurable anticipation, propped himself up on his cushions, and lay back for a few minutes more. It was an advance copy of a work to be published in millions of copies in 10 European languages, Renaud de Jouvenel's Tito, Traitor-in-Chief. It was a happy circumstance that the author could approach the dispute impartially, being an objective Frenchman, and, what was more, with an aristocratic de to his name. Stalin had read the book carefully some days earlier, and indeed had given advice when it was being written, but he was always reluctant to part with an enjoyable book. It would help so many millions of people to see through that vainglorious, conceited, cruel, cowardly, loathsome, hypocritical, villainous tyrant, that vile traitor, that hopeless blockhead. Even the Western communists had lost their bearings, didn't know whom to believe. Even that old fool, André Marty, would have to be expelled from the party for defending Tito. He paged through the book. There it was. Let nobody make a hero of Tito. On 2 occasions he had wanted, like the coward he was, to surrender to the Germans. But Arso Yovanovitch, his chief of staff, had forced him to go on being commander-in-chief. Noble Arso. Murdered. And what about Petrichevich? Murdered simply because he loved Stalin. Noble Petrichevich. The best people were always killed by somebody else. It fell to Stalin to finish off the worst. It was all there. How Tito was probably a British spy, how vain he was about his underpants with a royal monogram, his physical ugliness, his resemblance to Goering, all those diamond rings on his fingers, his chest full of medals and decorations. What pathetic vanity in a man unendowed with strategic genius. An objective, an ideologically sound book. Perhaps Tito was also sexually inadequate. That ought to be mentioned. The Yugoslav Communist Party is in the power of murderers and spies. Tito was only able to take over the leadership because Bela Kun and Trajco Kostov vouched for him. Kostov. Stalin felt a pang. The blood rushed furiously to his head. He stamped his foot. He kicked out violently, booting Trajco in the face, bloodying his ugly mug. Stalin's grey eyelids trembled with satisfaction that justice had been done. That damned Kostov. That filthy swine. Extraordinary how transparent the machinations of these scoundrels became in retrospect. They were all Trotskyists, but how cleverly they had disguised themselves. Kuhn, at least, had been polished off in 37, but it was only 10 days since Kostov had stood before a socialist court and reviled it. Stalin had managed so many trials successfully, compelled so many enemies to trample on themselves, and then the Kostov trial had gone disastrously wrong. It was a disgrace, with the whole world watching. The cunning of the man! To deceive experienced interrogators, grovel at their feet, then take it all back in open court, in the presence of foreign journalists. Where was his sense of decency? His communist conscience? His proletarian solidarity? Appealing to the imperialists. All right, so you're not guilty. But die anyway, for the good of communism. Stalin flung the book away. No. He must not lie down. Battle called. He rose, straightened up, but not all the way. Unlocked and locked behind him, the other door, not the one at which Paskryabyshov had knocked. His soft boots shuffled almost silently along a narrow, low-ceilinged, crooked hallway, also windowless. He went past the secret entrance to his underground driveway and stopped at a two-way mirror through which he could see the waiting room. He looked. Abakumov was already there, sitting with a big notebook in his hand, looking strained, wondering when he would be summoned. Stepping more firmly, no longer shuffling, Stalin went into his bedroom, which was also low-ceilinged, cramped, windowless, and air-conditioned. Under the oak panelling there was armour plating, and only then stone wall. With a little key that he carried in his waistband, Stalin unlocked the metal lid of a decanter, poured himself a glass of his favourite cordial, drank it, and locked the decanter again. He went over to the mirror. The eyes that had outstared Western premiers gazed back at him, stern and incorruptible. He looked austere, simple, soldierly. He rang for his Georgian orderly to get dressed. Even to a henchman, he would present himself as he would appear in the eyes of history. His iron will. His inflexible will. Never for a moment, never for a moment must he cease to be a mountain eagle.